This week on Art of the Air features multidisciplinary artist and photographer Sophie Gamond, whose work lives at the intersection of art, science, and spirituality. Next, we have an encore interview with Marla Schoffer, who curates artists from remote regions of the globe. Our spotlight's on the 43rd Annual Lebesnik Arts Festival, running August 16th and 17th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther, Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Lebesnik Center for Arts about the Lebesnik Arts Festival coming up. It's Jessie Sexton. She is the marketing manager, and she's going to tell us all about the festival coming up on Saturday, August 16th and August 17th. And you can find out information, of course, at lebesnikcenter.org. Jessie, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Jessie. It's nice to see you.
You too.
Wow, the big 43, huh?
Yeah, this is our 43rd year with the Lebesnik Art Festival. We're super excited. We can't wait. We've got over 80 artists that are, you know, going to be exhibiting indoor and outdoor. So, yeah, and we've got all types of artists. We're really excited about it.
Can you tell us ahead of time who the indoor artists are going to be this year?
Yes, we're excited. We've got some invited artists, so they won't be a part of the jurored exhibitions, but they will be just, you know, on display inside. And that's Tania DeLosa. She has also shown in our NIPSCO galleries a few months back. She's a really great artist that works with acrylic. She does a lot of geometric kind of shapes in her paintings. They're very colorful and bold, graphic. So we're excited to have her. And then we've also got two more artists, Avon Hannah Smith. He's also shown in the NIPSCO galleries in the past. He's really mixed media, so it's really neat to see all the kinds of materials that he works with. And then Antonio Rupert, she does fantastic portraits, and it looks like watercolor, maybe acrylic, but she does fantastic colorful portraits. So we're excited to have all three of them.
Does sound exciting.
So tell us a little bit about, well, there's a cost on one day, but there isn't on the other day. We need to explain how that works.
Yes. So it's just $5 on Saturday is the first day, August 16th. Just $5 entry. If you're under, you know, if you're a child, you are in for free. If you're a vet, you get in for free. So it's just general admission. And then Sunday, McDonald's of LaPorte County is so wonderful. They always sponsor the Sunday as a free family day. And so everyone gets in for free on Sunday. And another thing that we're going to be doing this year, we did it last year on Saturday, there is a free concert. It's a children's concert, Fairy Tales Around the World, at 2 p.m. indoors in our Heinemann Gallery. The Michigan City Chamber Music Festival will have a performance on Saturday.
Oh, that's cool. What about the live demos? What kind of live demos will there be? And what kind of family activities do you have?
Yeah, we have lots of family activities. Our education director, Nelsie Marcano, is fantastic with planning different things. So there'll be lots of interactive projects for the kids and families to do, face painting. And then I know we've got Michigan City's John Rizka coming back this year. And so I'm sure he'll be doing some kind of demos and, you know, explaining how he does his glass blowing. So that should be pretty cool as well. And there's always, you know, some of the artists like to live paint while they're there as well. So it'll be cool to walk around and see everything. And another thing that we're doing this year, we did it last year, community mural contest. So right now we have an opening contest. The deadline is July 25th for young artists, I think 18 and younger, 7 to 18. You can submit, you know, a drawing of something that kind of embodies community. And we will, you know, consider that as an option for a community mural that everyone can come and paint at the festival.
Now, so one of the important things is what food you have there. Tell us a little bit about the food.
Yes, we love Cabos. Cabos is going to be back. They're going to have their, you know, Mexican food and their ice cream. Their La Patrona is their food truck, and then Cabos ice cream. They'll be serving up some treats. And then we also have Shoreline Brewery coming back again, and they'll be serving up beer and wine.
So yeah. While that's going on, people can still see the exhibit. Tell us, and we've done an interview about the exhibit, but they can come into the main gallery and see what's going on with that. Tell us about that exhibit.
Yeah, so right now we have Women to the Front on display through October. So during the festival, you can come in and see it. It's both in our Heinemann Gallery and our upstairs Susan Block and Brinka Cross galleries. And it features over 70 works from a collection that has over 1,000 artworks. The collection belongs to Sarah Vance Waddell and her partner. And they are amazing. They've been collecting this work since the 90s. And Midwest artists, feminist artists, all women. I mean, we've got work from Yoko Ono. And then, you know, we've just got all types of up-and-coming artists as well in the show. And it is just a spectacular display, really it is. So we're excited to have that open to the public, and they can come see it during the festival.
What's the exhibit coming after that one?
It's called Lit, and it's going to be all about kind of lighting. I'm sure there will be photography, but there will be a lot of like actual lit up sculptures and things that kind of play with light and color. And so that one should be really interesting, too. And that'll open up in November.
Excellent. Anything after that you know of, or I'm sure you have the schedule planned out there, or?
I'm sure our curator has some ideas. I don't know much else about the other exhibits that'll be for next year, but I know it's in the works. So we're excited to see what Whitney comes up with because she's fantastic.
Well, yeah, we've had her on the show and she does a great, actually did a full interview with her to find out all about what she does. So in our last few moments here to recap on everything that's going on with the Art Point Art Festival.
Yeah. So it'll be August 16th and 17th. It's a Saturday and a Sunday, and it'll be from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central. Admission on Saturday is $5, unless you're a kiddo or a veteran, you know, a vet, and then you get in for free. And then Sunday is a free family day for all. And we're going to have over 80 artists, indoor, outdoor, lots of community activities, great food, great drinks. You can walk around with your, you know, Shoreline beer. So it should be a really great time. We're excited.
That's Jessie Saxon, marketing manager for Barton Civic Arts Center and the festival August 16th, 17th. And by the way, she didn't mention that Besnick Center members get in free. Thank you for coming on.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jessie.
Thanks for having me.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow.
This is author Christopher Grayson, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Sophie Gaumont to Art on the Air. Sophie is a French award-winning photographer, artist, and animal advocate living and working in Los Angeles now. She is a published author, speaker, and animal chaplain. She observes the entanglement between dogs and humans. Her work invokes dogs as mirrors and spiritual bridges, witnesses, and guides. Her work lives at the intersection of art, science, and spirituality, using various disciplines such as hand-stitched embroidery, new media, sculpture, or installations. She tells a powerful story of dogs and humans coexisting. She is well known for her photographs of shelter dogs, including her pit bull flower power series, as well as free-ranging dogs around the world. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Sophie. It is so, so wonderful to meet you.
Bonjour, and thank you so much for having me.
We always love to have our guests on and actually tell them a little bit about themselves. I call it their origin story, how they got from where they were to where they are now. So tell us all about Sophie.
That is such a big question, but I was born and raised in France. I lived in Switzerland for a while, and this is where I met the person who would become my husband. And we had a common language, which was English, because he's Swedish, I'm French, we met in Switzerland. It's very complicated. But we figured, let's just move to a place that speaks English, so we are kind of on a equal language ground. And we landed on New York. So we moved to New York and we spent 11 years there. And then recently after the pandemic, we moved to Los Angeles. So I've been here for a while now. My origin story, I guess I was born an artist, but it took me a lifetime to figure out how to be an artist in this world. And I'm still figuring it out every day, every step of the way. So it's been a journey.
So when you were younger, what art disciplines was the family artistic for one? And what art disciplines were you interested in? Because sometimes it takes a while to find the one that, you know, you truly connect with.
Right. And I don't know that I figured that out yet. But I guess my grandmothers were both creative, but not professionally. I mean, of course, that was a time too where they didn't get the luxury to be able to pursue arts. But on my dad's side, she was a poet. She wrote beautiful poetry, but was never really recognized within the family system as a poet. People would make fun of her. So it was a lot of shame wrapped around that. And then on my mother's side, my grandmother did ceramics and painted, but same thing, and sewed as well. But same thing, there was a lot of shame wrapped around her art practice. It was never really recognized. And I remember her telling me that none of the stuff that she was doing was good enough to be shown. And so I grew up with, strangely, access to these creative spirits, but also understanding that the creative process was wrapped in shame. And actually, as I'm formulating it with you, I'm connecting that dot. I don't think I've connected those dots before. I've always wondered, why is there so much shame wrapped in my creative process? And now maybe I just named it. So
It is so interesting because also, you know, I remember the exact moment when I knew my life would include color and art, I guess, in the bigger picture. But my whole, and so I just knew it. I felt it in every fiber of my being at 4 years old. But I was always told, it's so nice you can do this art thing, but you have to have something that's real. So yeah, you're right. There is always this push-pull with it.
Yes, and I guess the same happened to me. I was very creative at a very young age. I actually have an embroidery that I made when I was 5 in my office to remind myself, wow, this was always there. It just took a long journey to embrace it as something that is who you are and what you do. I studied law. I tried to be a good girl. You know, I went to... I did 5 years of law studies. I have a master's in law in France. And then I became chief editor of an art magazine. And I tried to work in an office in Geneva. And I was just suffocating. I was suffocating. I needed to be able to express myself creatively. And photography kind of happened a little bit by accident. Yes, I know. My father had an ad agency in the 80s. And so there was cameras laying around the house. And I was a little familiar with like black and white photography, and one day I decided to try it when I was in high school. So photography was part of my life on and off, but I never saw myself as a photographer, more so of an artist who liked to use photography sometimes. And when I was in New York, somehow, but some kind of weird twist of the universe, I became known for my photography, and so I kind of, by default, became a photographer, but not really, so...
Well, you add so much more to the photography, but I have one more childhood question. Can you sort of describe the French school system, like what the arts are like in France, in like elementary school, and I'm not even sure how the classes are there. We have elementary, middle, high school here.
Yeah, it's similar. And at least, I mean, I can talk about my generation, right? I grew up in mm-hmm. the 80s and 90s, so it could be different now, but we didn't have art classes so much, like theater and music. It's not really, it's integrated a little bit at the basic level, but not like it is here. So it's not particularly encouraged, although when I was in high school, you had the possibility of adding what we called options to your regular curriculum. And there was like three major branches. There was literature, math, and science, maybe? I forgot. But you could add options to these. So I did the literature one, and I added the math options, which was my mom's idea, and it was a disaster because I hated math. I should have never done it. And then I added the art option. And so I took art classes my last years of high school as an added thing. And it was so interesting because I was very much into more like conceptual art. I love trying ideas. The craft was not important to me as the idea was, and I wouldn't really want to get lost in the perfection of the details, more telling the story. And I remember telling a friend, like, oh, this comes so easily. It feels like I'm just manipulating people into believing something, but I'm not really doing the work, so surely it's all crap. And my friend said, have you ever thought that it's easy for you because you're meant to do this?
Right.
And my teacher was obsessed with my work. I was 17, 18, and he was obsessed, and he thought I was this genius. But I left that year, and I stopped making art after that. I think it just felt like first I had to enter real life, get a job, and be serious about my life, but also maybe because I hadn't really found that path for myself. I applied for an art school in Paris, and I was rejected. There was a lot of the capital of France, Paris, versus provincial peasantry. And because I was not from Paris, there was definitely, you know, the art scene there was very elitist and very close on Paris and who you knew there. And so I was not accepted in a program, even though I had really good grades and I would have been a great candidate. But that kind of set me on that path of like, oh, I guess I'm not really an artist, or I'm not, the world is not going to see me as such. And my dad is right. I should get a real job. I should. So, yeah, that led me to the path of law.
I would like to go back in and discover your photography. You know, you talked a little bit about it, picking up the cameras. And we do have photographers who listen to our show. So even getting into it, what equipment you use then and what you use now and how do you use it? And also what you post edit on.
Wow. Okay. So I was always a Nikon person, first off. There's a big Nikon versus Canon in the community.
I know.
Probably my father had Nikon gear laying around. Initially, I was very big on portraiture. I was very interested. I was a very introverted, shy kid and teenager, very uncomfortable in social situation, probably neurodivergent or whatever you want to call it, but just having really difficulties connecting with others. And with photography, it allowed me to create intimacy with people and animals in the way that allowed for distance. Mm-hmm. So my dad had an extremely long lens, probably, I don't even know how long it was. It was so long that you had to use a tripod to use it, but I did not know that back then. I was just a kid, so I would take photos and they would come all blurry, out of focus. I didn't mind. To me, it was, you know, part of, I don't know, my process, I guess. But back then, you know, we didn't have digital cameras, so everything had to be, you brought it to the store, you know, negatives are developed and then printed. And my dad was in charge of that process and paying for it. And one day he came home and he said, I'm not going to continue funding this. Everything is blurry. Basically, I stopped taking photos after that for a while. But portraiture was always my thing. And in 2007, I discovered digital photography and Photoshop. And my mind was blown. I started taking portraits and a lot of self-portraits and retouching them with Photoshop and creating whole new images that went way beyond just the simple act of photography. That's about my journey. Well, you ask me what tools I use. I still use Nikon and Photoshop mostly. I like pushing photography a little further, but I also enjoy taking photos when I work with free living dogs around the world or rescues. And I also love that capturing the moment in photography and not retouching it, just letting it be what it is. I'd love to do more of that. So, yeah, I see photography as a tool to tell stories and create the artwork that I want to see in the world.
And obviously, you probably shoot in RAW because anyone that does any...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I still run...
Well, you know, I started shooting JPEG.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot, and I still run into occasionally photographers that still run JPEGs, and I explain to them what RAW is. And I said, you know, it gives you... And, you know, they just don't... I said, it's just one more step in process. And even if you don't do much with it...
I know.
It's like you... And yet you can go back and generally you can recover. Like if you shot a low light picture, you can pull it up. Now, the other end of it, if you overexpose it, that in digital, it's gone. I mean, that's the other rule. So it's always my rule of thumb is I'm a photographer also, and but I am a Canon shooter, but always slightly underexpose. Yeah. Well, well, and real quickly, the thing, the debate on that happened was Nikon was the premier professional photography, and Canon was always like second tier. But that changed with digital. Olympus actually developed the processor, the CMOS processor. Everyone was using the CCD processor, which was from video. And so Canon used their digit processor to make it work. And most of, not everyone, but most of the guys that were shooting with Nikon threw their equipment over and bought Canon. Now it's back to equivalent, but Canon also is a larger company and had more money from develop. Both of them need to watch out for Sony. Sony's got a lot more money. So, but anyway, that
when I met my husband, we met through photography. Sorry, but so he was a Canon, I was a Nikon. He's the one who told me about RAW, and he saved my career, I'm sure, in many ways, because I was clueless and I thought, oh, but you know, it's so complicated, and I'm not a technical person. I don't want to learn it. And I have a friend whose career is picking up, and she's still shooting JPEG, and I'm trying to convince her you have to make the switch. If you take your art seriously and you want to keep growing and expanding, you have to learn that very basic RAW is the way to go and basic editing skills, yes.
Yeah. The only exception to that usually is sports photographers, because when they're shooting, they need the fast saving time that you have. So they a lot of times... Because they're not doing art photography. They're shooting multiple images. So they usually shoot JPEGs, high-end JPEGs, but everything. So let's talk about dogs. How did that meld into your art world, you know, with the photography and what you do with it?
Well, I guess, you know, as I mentioned, I was always very shy, and animals were kind of my safe space in that regard. I had a bunny growing up. That was my best friend. I grew up with family dogs as well. Oh, yeah, really? Yeah, bunny?
Oh, completely.
Oh, yeah, I loved her. And she lived for 10 years, which was pretty long for a small, like, miniature bunny. So it was very important for me to have animals in my life. But moving to New York, and as an adult, I hadn't had pets. And after I moved to New York, I started picking up photography again. And I wanted to do something that scared me. And that was street photography. I was really afraid of talking to strangers, pointing cameras at them. But I thought New York is the place to do it. So I signed up for a class thinking I'm just going to push my boundaries a little bit and try to figure out who am I going to be in New York? What am I going to do with my life here? And the first assignment was go to your neighborhood and photograph a stranger and tell their story in 5 frames. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is like my worst nightmare. There's no way I can do this. And so I ventured in my neighborhood. I had just moved there like a few weeks before. I knew nothing. My English was not as good as it is now. And I saw a vet clinic and I decided, you know, maybe I could work with people at the vet clinic. There would be animals to talk about. That gives us like a buffer again for that conversation. And I sat in the waiting room and there was a little bulldog with blue eyes that were just peeking from behind a wall, and he looked at me, and he looked so human-like and so out of place and scared and, like, worried. And he looked at me as if to say, like, do you know what they're going to do to me here? And I just took that photo, and I went home, and I realized, wow, this is what I want to do. I want to explore how dogs integrate in our lives, and especially in the place like New York City, which is so unnatural for animals and dogs in particular. And I became friends with the owner of the vet clinic, so I got to spend a lot of time there observing how they handled animals, how the animals lived in that environment. And then I met a rescuer, and I discovered the world of dog rescue and shelters, and it kind of opened up this whole world to me. And I knew I had to do my share, which for me was to take photos of dogs who were waiting for adoption, help them get adopted, take photos of rescues doing the work so that I could raise funds to help their mission. And that opened a whole career by some weird connections.
So did the flowers come before the wet dogs, or which way did it go?
Wet dog was first. It was in the fall 2014. I was burned out from a lot of rescue work I had been doing, and I needed something light and fun. And I photographed the project in one afternoon. It was not what I was there to shoot. I was working with a groomer, and I thought, I'm just going to open myself up to the process today. Whatever comes my way, I'm going to take photos, and I'm just going to let it in. And when the groomer started bathing the dogs, I was like, wow, this looks so interesting visually. And I started photographing the dogs dripping with water. And then I started laughing and realizing there's something there. That project went viral and was my really first big project that really gave me a career. I signed a book deals. I won the Sony World Photography Award. And suddenly I had a career and I was completely shocked. And then a few months later, I photographed Pitbull Flower Power thinking, I'm going to do 5 portraits of shelter pit bulls wearing flower crowns. And then I will just move on with my life. But the project went viral even more, and is basically now 11 years old, and I'm still crowning pit bulls in shelters occasionally, and the project still has a lot of fans and supporters around the world, so it's pretty, pretty cool.
And so what, you know, the photographs were very interesting and delightful. And so when did you start adding the ceramics and the embroideries and expanding what you did? And then where did the chaplainship, when did that happen? I mean, it progresses so beautifully.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I think I mentioned before, I never saw myself as a photographer. And when my work went viral and I got known for Wet Dog and Pitbull Flower Power, I was almost disappointed. Like, oh, this is what, you know, they say, be careful the path you start on, because that's the path you're going to have to continue on. There's a saying around that concept. And I think it's very true, especially as a creative or an artist. Once you pick a path, it's very hard to change, because especially if you have success with it. Everybody wanted more dogs, more shelter dogs, more pit bulls in flower crowns. And so for 10 years, I just did it. And during the pandemic, I realized I needed more. I needed to continue exploring what the artist in me wanted to explore and break free of that formula that was working, paying the bills and giving me tons of amazing opportunities and helping dogs and rescues. It was amazing. It ticked all the boxes. But deep inside, there was something in me that was longing for more. And so since the pandemic, I tried to step away from rescue a little bit so I could make more room for other things. And last year, I went through a training to become an animal chaplain, and I was ordained with that. And that has informed also the work that I do. So the ceramics, for example, you know, I created a line of ceramics called the Sacred Dog, and it's inspired by ceremonies and rituals chaplains, for example, could do with animals. It's inspired by mythologies around the world where dogs have been considered as psychopomps, which is guides to the souls. So in a lot of stories, the dogs accompany humans in the afterlife, guards them against evil forces, or help them cross obstacles. You know, it happens in pretty much every culture around the world, from China to ancient Greece to
They're very
Mesoamerica.
Egyptian in feel, I think. They look very Egyptian.
Oh, the ceramics.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people tell me that, but I mean, obviously I was informed by things I've seen in my life, but I like Etruscan art, which is like an ancient Italian. Yes. I like Mesopotamian art. Coming from France, we have a lot of caves, painted caves, you know, that are 30,000 years old. So I think I'm informed by a lot of that. I love mythology and the sacredness of those stories and the images that go with. So I'm able to inform all the work I've done until now and the projects I want to keep growing and the stories I want to tell. And I'm working on a few new projects right now. I just did an art residency at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles, which was really, really cool. And I'm unleashing a lot, basically, no pun intended, but I'm trying to unleash a lot of the artist heart that I have and all the projects I want to put out in the world.
What was the basis of the residency?
Oh, basically,
what were you focusing on?
They have a very small dog collection because they focus on wildlife. But when the museum was created, I think their first exhibit was an exhibit of dog specimens. So they have like four drawers of boxes with dog skeletons and skulls. And I was just very intrigued. As a kid, I wanted to be an anthropologist. Mm. So bones, digging up stories and things was always very interesting to me. And I figured, oh, what if I just sat with those bones and see? And one idea that I developed there was, it might be too long for how little time we have left on this conversation, but I'm a very big advocate against the way we've been breeding dogs, especially brachycephalic dogs, which are the dogs who have a flat face, like Frenchies and pugs. The way they're bred can lead to a lot of suffering for these dogs because they cannot breathe normally. And coincidentally, at the museum, a lot of the skulls that they have are from brachycephalic dogs because I guess in the 20s, you know, veterinarian or people were like really interested in this objet de curiosité or whatever, you know, that they look a little different. So I was able to create this project I've been dreaming of for a long time, which was to create wallpaper pattern using the skeletons of these dogs. And that echoes Victorian wallpapers that were laced with arsenic. So in the 1800s, A lot of wallpapers were using arsenic in the paints, mm-hmm. and people were getting sick and people were dying from breathing the fumes. And so it's an echo to that idea of, because we think they're pretty and cute, these dogs, we breed them in a way that makes it difficult for them to breathe. And we're admiring, oh, how cute and beautiful they are. And we forget the health, we forget the safety, we forget all these important things. And so that was one of the projects I did. And there's a few other projects I shot there that I'm very excited about.
To talk to you when you come back.
Well, we'll have to wrap this up at here, Sophie. Tell us your website and how people can reach out to you.
My website is a great place to start, and it's sophiegamand.com. Although Esther pronounced it beautifully, Gamand is the French way to pronounce it, but Gamand is the American way. And then you can find me on social media, Instagram being the main place to find me, and that's at sophiegamand. And that's where I post a lot of my work.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art on the Air, Sophie Gamand. And you can find out all her work there. And we will have her picture on our website that will link you to her website. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your art journey and your dog journey.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure. And we'll have to have you back.
This is Mary Clark, the author of Dandelion Roots Run Deep. And you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM. And WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Marla Schoeffer to Art on the Air. Marla spent more than 25 years in corporate marketing when she decided to follow the winding road toward her passion of travel and exploring exotic places. Her love of discovery and shopping for the unique and unusual led her to develop partnerships with artisans in Nepal, India, Morocco, Peru, Bali, and Borneo. She works with artisans on product design, and her company, The Winding Road, handles importing, shipping, and sales. Marla has the most inspiring and beautiful story to tell about what her winding road has accomplished. Thank you, Marla, for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. It is so good to see you again.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, Marla, we're excited to have you on the show. And of course, what we always like to start off with our guests is kind of their origin story. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Marla.
Okay, well, I grew up in Michigan, a suburb of Detroit called West Bloomfield. And when I was young, I always wanted to be an artist. I used to paint and draw and do ceramics and was not particularly encouraged by my family to pursue that as a career. But one thing I was very lucky to do is my mother particularly really loved travel. And as a young age, when other people were going to Florida, we would come back from spring break having gone to Morocco. So I did have quite a lot of ability to see the world and also notice at a pretty young age that there were people living, for example, in Morocco, extremely poor and on the street, and seeing that at a young age gave me a different type of view of the world. I ended up, fast forward a little bit, I went to Michigan State, studied advertising, and moved to Chicago and worked for many years in advertising agencies on big brands like Procter & Gamble, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard, and then ended up out in San Francisco working for Levi Strauss & Company. And I started my business called The Winding Road at age 50. So that was 12 years ago. Got laid off from a corporate job and said, you know, I just don't see going back and working for a corporate job. And who's going to want to hire a 50-year-old woman anyway? So I kind of woke up that Monday morning and I said, I know, I'm going to start a business and it's going to be called The Winding Road. And I'm going to do what I love doing, which is traveling around the world and working with artisans and bringing their goods back to the U.S. My experience was in marketing, you know, merchandising, design, and I had previous to that traveled a few times to, you know, India and other places where I would just bring back stuff in my backpack and open it up. And all my friends would say, wow, I've never seen anything like that before. So my happiest excitement in the world is walking through a market in Egypt or Turkey, you know, or Greece and just seeing and noticing things that I've never seen before that I really want to bring back to the U.S. So on one of my trips, I decided to start my business by going to Nepal, where I had been the year before. And I wrote a business plan and I knew I was going to bring back cashmere scarves and shawls. I knew what quantity I wanted to buy. I knew what I wanted to pay. And then I thought I would have this idea in my mind of how many I would sell. But while I was there, I walked into this tiny little 10 by 10 foot shop that this young guy with a big smile on his face was just opening for the first time with his wife. And he was putting things on the shelf. And I said, wow, these are really beautiful. And his goods looked different than anything else that was in the area. You know, he got a little spot on a little touristy area and his name is Madhav. And I said, I can bring your things back to the U.S. I'm just starting a business and I'm going to go to the San Francisco gift fair. And if I get orders, will you be able to quickly fulfill the orders? And of course, he was very eager to do business with an American. So he said yes. And I put his goods up in the little booth at Moscone Center in San Francisco. And my first two customers were the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, who still, 12 years later, are still buying from us. They're still good customers. But Madhav has a very interesting story. He just came to visit in January for 3 weeks, and it was his first trip to the U.S. He grew up in a small village outside in Nepal, outside of Kathmandu, with 68 families, one school room with a dirt floor. His family were water buffalo farmers, so he was out in the field herding water buffaloes as a kid without any shoes. He never saw TV or radio until he was 15 years old. So like, if I think about, you know, my background, like when I was a kid watching, you know, anything on TV, you know, the Galloping Gourmet or, you know, travel shows or, you know,
Wild or actually Kingdom. Traveling to Morocco when you were young.
Yeah. Or Wild Kingdom. I mean, just having access to all of this, he never saw a white person and he never saw TV until he was 15. And then as a young adult, teenager, you know, old teenager, young adult, moved to Kathmandu because there were no opportunities in his village. And he got a job in a t-shirt shop, learned English, interacted with tourists. And he had two dreams. One was he wanted to one day go to college. And two, he wanted to one day come to America. And so one day this Canadian tourist walks in and was talking to him. And he's very personable and friendly. And Madhav says, the guy's like, what do you want to do in life? And he goes, I want to go to college. And the guy said, well, how much does college cost? And he told him, and the guy's like, well, that's not that much. I'll pay for you to go to college. So he got to go to college. And then later he kept in touch with the guy. And then he wanted to get a master's degree in public health. And this Canadian man paid for his master's degree. So he started his business. I walked in, I was his first customer. And after a couple of years, I went to the New York Now, which is this big trade show in New York. We are in a showroom in the Atlanta, America's Mart in Atlanta twice a year. We have big shows there. And I am now in over his goods in over 1,000 retail stores across the U.S., Canada. We are regularly shipping to Australia and all over Europe. So kind of leading up to COVID for a few years, suddenly he'd say, oh, we have 30 women artisans working on your goods. And I think, wow, that's amazing, because it just started out with him and his wife and like one person making things. And the artisans there in Nepal, Nepal has a history of extreme poverty, where families who are very desperate may sell their daughters or wives or young women into human trafficking and the sex trade. And it's not uncommon. It can happen at the border with India. People can be taken to the Middle East and being told that they're going to be domestic servants in someone's home, but it goes beyond that. So all of these women that we employ would be at risk for human trafficking. Most of them have not been to school. The illiteracy rate among women in villages, rural areas, women my age, it's 90%. 90% of women have not been to school and cannot read and write. And sometimes, you know, if you think about, you want to walk into a store and you want to see what's on a label, or you get, you know, you walk down the street and you want to see what's on a street sign. You know, it's just, it makes someone, a woman, completely incapable of really being able to do anything if they can't read.
Very vulnerable.
Yes. So there today, though, that's changing. The new generation in Nepal, you know, 80-90% of kids are in school and can read and write. And that's changing a lot, because women have the opportunity to work, to contribute to their household income, and then pay to send their kids to go to school, because the education system, the government run education system, isn't very good. So if you want your kid to go to a good school, you have to pay a minimal amount. It's like $350 a year, which for us isn't a lot, but for them is quite a lot. So like leading into COVID, all of a sudden one day I was asking him, you know, how many people are working now? And he said, we have 60 women working. And I was just blown away that my business is supporting 60 women in Nepal. And then right before COVID, it was 160 women. And I was just like, wow, I can't believe I started this business and I'm employing and giving livelihood and improving the lives of 160 women. Well, during COVID, our business actually grew, and I just kept getting more goods. I kept paying my suppliers, and a lot of other felt business. We make handmade felt goods is what we're selling from him, like ornaments and mobiles and stuff. But suddenly during COVID, I guess it wasn't that sudden, we ended up hiring more and more women artisans, and we now have 400 women artisans working on our goods in Nepal.
Wow. Bravo.
And a lot of it happened during COVID, when our business really expanded quite a bit during that time.
And so that is just in Nepal. What about what's going on in all the other countries that you work with?
Well, I have one big supplier in Morocco, and we continued. I mean, COVID was a big challenge, and each country had its own challenge. And we continued to buy all during that time. So I have one supplier in Morocco. We get our goods in, and we have them in our warehouse. I have a woman down in Peru who I met when I was in Cusco. And she has an interesting story as well. She had a single mother in Peru, and they were pretty poor. And when she was a child, her mother would put her out on the sidewalk with a blanket selling keychains to tourists when she was maybe 5 years old. And so she learned how to interact with tourists. She learned English. She eventually did go to college, and then she had her own shop in one of the markets, and it was merchandised really well. And I could see she had a good idea for design. She was probably in her 20s when I met her. And I continued to, during COVID, buy from her and one other woman down there that kind of disappeared, but we managed to find her. But a lot of the markets where you would have stalls and tourist trade just completely shut down. That's what happened in Nepal also, is that the touristy area in Kathmandu completely shut down, and other felt suppliers that depended on tourism shut down, and we were able to provide jobs for some of these women that lost their jobs during that time. We also allowed some of them, you know, we said it's going to be temporary in one case, because I have two suppliers there, and the one supplier lost a lot of business, and we said, hey, we'll take your workers during this time and keep them working on our stuff. And then when, you know, tourism peaks again, comes back, we'll give you your people back. So that worked out pretty well. They don't work as their as competitors. They work their society kind of everyone works together. You know, they don't think like after the earthquake that everyone's going to go buy all of the baby formula and all of the toilet paper out of a store.
Right.
I'm going to buy what I need and I'm going to leave everything else so my neighbors have something. It's a very different thing, but yeah.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Yeah, I want to go back to Nepal, actually, because the winding road then has gotten to the place where you sponsor children to go to school with full scholarships as well. And that's all from this tiny first visit.
I was trying to think about maybe it's an American way of thinking, but how do we make our place of employment someplace where people want to work, where people say, oh, you should go work for this supplier because what we do is we pay medical expenses to the workers because there isn't Blue Cross across the country. You just can't get health insurance, but it's not that uncommon for workers to take employers to take responsibility. So if someone says, hey, I have got a medical bill for my son or my husband or myself, we pay that. We pay bus fare into work. We are paying, we are paying for some of the kids to go to school. So that's a scholarship program. And I also did for my supplier a micro loan I said, you know, he's building a new factory and he needed like $30,000 or $40,000. And I said, why don't you ask me and two other, he's got two people like me in Europe that represent about 2% of his business. So I represent about 98% of his business, but I gave him a loan so that, he could build this new factory that is earthquake proof and it's really clean and it has bathrooms so that we wouldn't be doing production with everybody sitting on a dirt floor, which is what's very common there to start a business and people are just working outside on the dirt. So the beautiful new facility, the loan was, you know, it's just an $8,000 loan, but it was interest free. I gave him 2 years to pay it off and I only made him pay $7,000 instead of $8,000. So I gave him $1,000 and I told him the $7,000 could come as a deduction from a future invoice instead of actual cash, which means on the $7,000 that really only cost him about $3,000 because he was taking it off of his invoice to me, but his actual costs are about half of what the invoice is. So, you know, just trying to think about
things. So lovely.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the COVID story is quite interesting because, you know, my business went up like dipped a little during COVID, but the year after COVID, it was up maybe 55%. And I think what happened during COVID is I was at the New York Now show in February and the Atlanta Gift Show in January. And right when I was coming back from New York, it was on the news that there's some virus that's kind of being seen a little bit here and there in the U.S. and we should all be really concerned. And it just started being on the news every single day. And I thought, okay, I have like a huge stack of orders. I need to start packing and shipping as fast as I can because at some point everything's going to shut down. And sure enough, one day all the stores were closed. People were canceling their orders with me. My good customers kept their orders, but other people said, well, we don't know what's going to happen. So push the date in the future by 2 months or 3 months or cancel the order. But I had goods that I put into production in Nepal and Morocco and Peru, and I know all my suppliers, and I just was committed to them. And I said, I already gave you a deposit. I'm going to send you the balance due, and we're going to figure out how to get all these goods here because there's a lot of uncertainty. But I knew that if I didn't get my goods here and I didn't have anything to sell and I didn't have a business for a year, that I would be okay. But I thought for sure that if these people didn't have jobs and they didn't have money, that they could starve, they could be on the street. So I sent all the money. And then as the time came to get everything shipped, the U.S. border closed and there was a lot of uncertainty about you know, what exactly that meant, because the word was all Americans have to be in back in the U.S. by this date. And we didn't know if cargo planes were going to be flying, if cargo could come in. We didn't know. So the day after the border closed, I had a I forgot to say that I also do production in Bali in Indonesia. And I had this shipment leaving Bali, and my shipper there was, you know, do you want us to get it on a plane, because the airport in Denpasar, Bali is closed, and then we have to put it on a ship and get it to Jakarta. But we can do that. Okay, so I call my logistics people in Chicago and I said, okay, is O'Hare Airport open for cargo? Are they receiving cargo today? Yes, they are. We just had a big plane come in from China. Okay, is U.S. Customs open and can they clear customs? Yes, they are. So I go, let it fly. So this huge shipment, it's like $60,000 worth of handbags coming from Bali. I can track everything by tracking the flight. I can see in real time, like where the flight is. There's a way to do that. And it was going to land in Dubai. So it lands in Dubai and it disappears off the radar. It's gone. It's like $60,000 gone. And I then go, oh, I bet they closed their airport. So I Google Dubai airport. This is, mind you, while I'm in bed at 2 a.m. tracking my stuff, found that the airport closed, and that 2,000 people were stuck in the airport because they couldn't get back to the U.S. They couldn't get back to India. And then I go on to Google again the United Arab Emirates website for the airport, and I see that they're going to run 2 cargo shipment to the U.S. One is going to come to Chicago O'Hare, luckily, and my goods did get here. So just a lot of things like that, all for like a year of just, you know, everything getting stuck on ships, getting stuck on planes, getting stuck in the Chicago rail yards. But I did get everything here. And then when the stores could not get goods and all the shelves were empty here, people were calling me in a panic, retailers, do you have goods? And I said, yes, I do. So that's why my business did well, as I just managed, you know, thick or thin, just to get everything here. And I did. Yep.
And keeping all those people employed during that time is just so wonderful.
What a tremendous story. Hey, Marla, yeah. What do you do for fun? I mean, oh my gosh, it seems like this is like an overwhelming thing that you do almost all the time. But, you know, what do you kick back and say, okay, what do I want to do for fun?
Well, luckily, the things that I love doing in life are all related to product development and travel. And
just like artists, yes.
I'm obsessed and passionate about what I do, and I work a lot. But yes, I kayak and I ride bikes and I travel, but yeah. I'm lucky that I figured out how to create a job for myself that just completely fires on every angle of what I love doing. So,
where haven't you gone that you want to discover? Like, what is your, because I know so much of your time is spent traveling to Nepal and Morocco and keeping all of those connections. But again, sort of.
There's no place else I want to go for sourcing because I'm 61. And I also want to say, ladies, don't tell you that you're too old to do anything. But it takes an awful lot to go somewhere, do the intelligence work of discovering new suppliers, figuring out who's going to work and who's not. So I'm just more or less now focusing in on the one.
I was thinking about pure pleasure. Yeah.
I can't think about pure pleasure at all. But there's places, I mean, I do love Indonesia. I love Bali. I love Nepal. So I love Peru. So
do you still do any kind of consulting? I mean, that kind of is your background, that you did that for a long time. Did someone say, well, how do I do my small business maybe locally? And would you give them some advice on that, or just plain advice?
I might give plain advice, but I wouldn't take on a big project of consulting with someone because I don't have time to do that. Too complicated. It's too much detail to just tell someone how you created something over 12 years of time. To boil that down into an hour is pretty hard.
Exactly. And we kind of touched on this, but do you do anything creative yourself anymore? Or, you know, you've just concentrated on what you're doing with these folks, which is a tremendous thing that you're doing.
I do. I studied photography when I lived in San Francisco, and I do photography more for myself. And luckily, because I have the skills and the background, I can do a lot of my own product photography also.
Very good. Well, we've got about a minute and a half left. We want to know kind of your website, how to contact you. What kind of products would we see there if we went to your website and, you know, contact information?
Well, my website is mostly wholesale, and my business is that I sell to retail stores. My website is called shopthewindingroad.com, and there is a contact me section, but for consumers, you'd have to maybe contact me and I can tell you what retail store it's in, but we don't have a direct-to-consumer website.
And what are some examples of the retail stores you might be able to be found in real quick?
Well, we're J. Paul Getty Museum, SF MoMA, in the Chicago. Well, I live in Geneva, Illinois, so we're in the Little Traveler. So it's a lot of fair trade stores. Yep.
Very good. Well, you know, we appreciate you coming on Art on the Air. What a tremendous story you have and sharing with our audience. I mean, we really didn't have to ask any questions. We just kind of teed you up and
so
let you
beautiful.
Go.
Beautiful.
What a beautiful story. That's Marla Schoffer, and you can find her website and everything like she just gave you. Marla, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, so much so. A complete pleasure.
We'd like to thank our guest this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.